Welcome everybody for hanging on to the last panel. So this is an interesting panel because this is a newly emerging area of great importance in the stem cell field, and we have some great speakers on this particular panel. What I'm going to do is for those not familiar with this, I'm going to give just a quick two-minute overview of what we mean about modeling human disease. And for the lay public, very often we just call it disease in a dish. And basically the concept is either that one takes normal cells, typically derived from stem cells, and stresses and perturbs them in prescribed ways, or even more trendy now is to take disease cells. In other words, cells derived from a patient, typically turning them into iPS cells. And the advantage of doing that is now to use these cells to study mechanisms of the disease, to identify cellular signatures, diagnostic, prognostics, biomarkers, drug targets, and then maybe even discover some of the drugs against those targets, or at least leads to drugs, or at least something that can compensate for the pathology. Now, even though it's getting a lot of attention, those of us who have been in the stem cell field for a very long time recognize this is not new. Even in the early days, in the late 80s, early 90s, mid-90s, we would go to either fetuses, and I was trained as a neuroscientist, so we'd go to the nervous system of abortuses or miscarriages or fetuses or autopsy specimens from diseased patients and look and make neural stem cells, for example, to see whether those could model whatever the disease was that the patient or the fetus died of. With the advent of the ESL field, we had the opportunity to go to blastocysts that had been diagnosed as having a disease from pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, turn them into ESLs, and then try from pluripotent cells to study that particular disease. And of course, the advent of iPS technology made it possible to get difficult to obtain cell types from living patients, which was a great advantage. Everybody is very familiar with making iPS cells, and I think we'll even hear about skipping the pluripotent stage and going directly from an accessible tissue to an inaccessible tissue directly, called transdifferentiation. And of course, now one gets more than just nervous system. You can, if you know the right recipe, get whatever cell type is of interest to you or to the particular disease. Now, for those who do genomic profiling, I've been said, well, why would you ever, you know, if you just want to profile the genome, why do you have to go all the way to making iPS cells? Well, I think most people in this audience recognize that when you make an iPS cell, in addition to genetic information, you get a functional cell biological dimension that you wouldn't get just by looking at the genome. You can get multiple lineages, sometimes clonally related, often in large numbers and uniform, so that you can really try to understand disease susceptibility or responsiveness. And then if you're interested in a gene defect, particularly if it's present in all cells, maybe you can understand why, for example, a disease that has the defect in every single cell is a neurologic disease, not a kidney disease, for example, Huntington's disease. Ways that I think you'll hear in the panel that people use the derivatives of iPSL are omics, trying to find out fingerprints, subjecting these cells to stimulants or inducers or stressors or perturbogens to try to understand pathway analysis, turning them into biosensors so that you can screen compounds that then give you a response that you think is desirable and may be therapeutically useful, to look at candidate gene testing, and now the advent of very efficient gene editing is starting to make that a very attractive use of iPS cells. And then, of course, correlating these with clinical outcomes, doing heavy-duty bioinformatic analysis, trying to get panels of biomarkers, all of which ultimately might get us to personalized medicine. Notice that I'm not at all in any way, and this panel will not deal with the notion of using iPS cells as graft material. That's not what we're going to be talking about here, though that obviously in some quarters is a use that these cells might be useful for. So we have three speakers that have really made great inroads in this entire field of modeling human disease. The way I'd like to run this is each of the speakers will do a 15-minute presentation, and what I'm hoping we'll do is go through those, hold the questions, and then that should give us a lot of time for a panel discussion, because a lot of the questions that are going to be posed are going to go across speakers, and we'll probably get to the essence of how well are we modeling human disease. So the first speaker is going to be Joe Wu from Stanford, followed by Juan Carlos from Salk, and then Inder Verma from the Salk.
So I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here, especially thanks to Evans for giving this a wonderful introduction, and also thanks to Mark McCullough, who is a great friend of mine, invited me here to give this talk. And so I'm going to talk, I'm a cardiologist by training, so most of my talk is going to be how we use iPS cells for cardiac disease modeling, for cardiac drug discovery at the Stanford Cardiovascular Institute. So this is my disclosure slide right here, and let me just switch to this. So we have some partnerships with a couple companies, and also we recently started a small startup company, and I think I'll only show one slide about the startup company that we did because of this particular emphasis of the forum. It's called Stem Cell Diagnostics. It's incorporated in 2011. Exclusive licensing from Stanford in 2013, Series A in 2014. It's focused on disease modeling and drug discovery. Myself, Bobby Robbins, and Andrew Lee are the co-founders, and we recently recruited Chris Armstrong to be the CEO of the company, and Stanford is also one of the major investors for this company. So I'm going to shift gear to what the main focus of the talk is. I think most of you would know that the cardiovascular disease remains the number one cause of morbidity and mortality in the U.S., both for men and women. It's much higher than cancer, accidents, and other diseases as well. And so I've been at Stanford for about 10 years. I went there in 2004. And at that time, we were mainly interested in taking human ESL, differentiated into cardiomyocytes, and use it for transplantation purpose. That's the other arm that Evans referred to about the cell therapy. And then when Shania discovered that you could take skin or blood and make iPS cells, and it became a game changer for us because, as you know, we can now make iPS cells from everybody in this room. And then if some of you have a disease, then we can understand the disease mechanism. And then likewise, what we're really interested in doing is doing this with drug discovery and drug testing. And so I won't go over the exact details of how do we do cardiac differentiation. We've been working on it for basically 10 years, from 2004 to 2014. There are different protocols out there, and if you're interested in the cardiac differentiation protocol, you can. I will refer you to this review article here. I just want to summarize what we've been able to do. So this is in 2004, in which you can see this is a cardiac differentiation run using human ESLs at that time. At that time, we're getting about 5% differentiation. The problem is here. Here is what cardiologists call junk cells. We don't want these cells. We want these cells right here, but we don't want these. I mean, these could be brain cells, bone cells, or whatever cells that we're not interested in. And so this is in 2004. And in 2014, it's very easy for us to get blood from our patients and isolate the PBMC, generate the iPS cells, and go do a differentiation run in which we're getting about 90% plus differentiation efficiency. And each batch run will get about 200 million cells. And from each batch run, a lot of times we'll bank it and we'll also ship it to our collaborators free of cost. And so you actually don't need a microscope. I mean, you can see this beating heart cells right here in this six-well dish right here. And so this is, I think the process of making the cardiac differentiation has improved dramatically over the past 10 years. The other thing that's high priority for us is because we want to expand the number of cardiomyocytes that we make. In the past, we've noticed batch-to-batch variability depending on the E8 or the MTSA bottles that we get because of the FBS amount. So it took us about 3 years to come up with this chemically defined generation of human cardiomyocytes. And in essence, this allows us to make cardiomyocytes, I said, a more precise way, more defined way, without this a lot of variation. And we boil it down to basically three compounds. It's a chemically defined media, basal media, L-ascorbate acid, and human recombinant albumin. I think the other advantage of this protocol is that in our lab, for example, when we generate this media bottle, it usually costs us about $50 per bottle. And so this is a dramatic cost saving if you're thinking about industrial size production of the cardiomyocytes. So with this in the background, I want to quickly give you what we're trying to do in terms of disease modeling and also in terms of drug discovery that Evans mentioned about. So this is a cardiomyocyte, and within the cardiomyocyte, there are many, many different kinds of diseases that could occur. Channelopathies right here, CPVT, ARVD, cardiomyopathy here. And so I'm going to focus on two diseases here. These are the dilated and the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. For the non-cardiologists out there, this is a somebody with a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, very, very thick septum, very thick posterior wall. It's the most prevalent inherited cardiovascular disease. One in about 500 people will get affected with this disease. It's actually one of the most common causes of sudden cardiac death. So if you have a young kid who dropped dead or passed on the football field, basketball court, once the young kid is resuscitated, this is what the cardiologists are looking for. Very thick muscles, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Many genes have been identified, and back in 1989, Christine Simons could identify myosin heavy chain 7 as the first gene involved in this process. So we were able to recruit a large family in which the mother has a disease, and she, lucky for us, she had 8 kids, and not so lucky for her, she had 8 kids as well. And so kids 1, 2, 3, and 7 have the mutation. Kids 1 and 2 have the phenotype. Phenotype is on the MRI. This is a sagittal cut at the MRI. You can see a very thick septum right here. We did whole genome sequencing to show the mutation. It's at a myosin heavy chain 7 with the alternating to histone switch. And so the question for us is, if we make iPSL differentiate the cardiomyocytes, do these kids, 1, 2, 3, and 4, the cardiomyocytes will look different from 4, 5, 6, and 8? And that's one main question. And we did this about 3 to 4 years ago, and what struck us was that the hypertrophic kids, the iPSL cardiomyocytes have larger cell size, shown here compared to the normal kids. They're also more multinucleated, and you can aggravate the hypertrophy by giving them some kind of stress. This, you know, this is exactly what Evans was talking about. In this case here, we give isoproterenol stress, and you can show the aggravation of the hypertrophy. We also show that there's increased nuclear translocation of MFAT, consistent with activation of the calcineurin pathway, and then we can block this by cyclosporine and FK506. And so these are the cell size comparison and the multinucleation comparison. Clinically, a lot of these patients actually have arrhythmia, so, you know, sometimes they drop dead playing sports, and sometimes they drop dead just watching TV. And what's striking to us was that these cardiomyocytes also have arrhythmia on in vitro, and this is the calcium imaging showing the arrhythmias right here. So we can come in with the calcium channel blocker, verapamil, to block the arrhythmia right here. And also the calcium channel blocker would also block the hypertrophy. So this is quite interesting for us in terms of developing an assay and then coming in to prove that the cells have, the drugs have some kind of effect. So this has already been published. I won't go into all the experimental details. I just want to highlight what we think is happening. Is that the mutation, myosin heavy chain 7 mutation, causes an increased intracellular calcium, leads to calcium handling defects, leads to arrhythmia. There's also activation of the MFAT signaling pathway that I told you earlier, which leads to hypertrophy. We screen for propranolol. We know propranolol blocks these two pathways. We also screen for lidocaine, mixolydine, and ranolazine, and we show that it blocks arrhythmia. And we also screen for verapamil and cyclosporine A. So this is one example. The other example that I quickly highlight is dilated cardiomyopathy. This is actually one of the most common causes of heart transplants in young kids as well, and also for adults. So in this particular family, this kid right here had a heart transplant already. His father also has cardiomyopathy, and his grandmother has a cardiomyopathy. So it runs in the family, because it runs in the family, we call it familial dilated cardiomyopathy. The DNA sequencing is a troponin T mutation with the arginine tryptophan switch. Just like the previous study, make the iPS cell, differentiate the cardiomyocytes, took us about 3 years to fully characterize what's going on with the mutation, why the cells are not squeezing, and coming with drugs that block it. In this case here, we did the beta blocker, as well as a Circa2A. Circa2A, interestingly, is already in clinical trial. It's called the CUPID trial, using AAV virus with Circa2A to improve patients with the heart failure. So I gave you two examples of how we model diseases using genetic mutations, hypertroph and dilated. You will see in the next 5 years or 10 years or so, more and more people will start going after acquired or multifactorial diseases. In cardiology, for example, you know, what is the mechanism of radiation-induced cardiomyopathy? What is the mechanism of autoimmune? What is the mechanism of storage cardiomyopathy and so forth? And I think the iPSL cardiomyopathy is a perfect model platform to study this. And just to give you an example of how we model acquired cardiomyopathy, this is a recent study that we did in which we were going after viral cardiomyopathy. Viral cardiomyopathy is a very interesting disease. Usually the patient come in, heart failure, we did an angiogram, and the angiogram shows no blockage, and the patient tells you that 2 to 3 months ago, he or she had a flu. And then the cardiologist would kind of say, okay, you got a flu, that means you probably have viral cardiomyopathy. And so in this case here, we can generate the iPS cells, differentiate the cardiomyocytes. We then reintroduce it with Kawasaki B virus, except it's tagged to luciferase. So the higher the transfection, the higher the luciferase signal. And so you can determine the amount of transfection. And then once you develop this in vitro platform, you can then come in with antiviral drugs to block it, right? So if you have a drug that does not affect the color, that means the drug is probably not effective. If you have a drug that blocks the color production, that means the drug is antiviral drugs. And so I won't go into the details of it. In this paper, we actually screened about five different drugs to show that some of the drugs work and some of the drugs do not work for viral cardiomyopathy. So what I want to do is shift gear to the second phase of my talk, which is on how do we do this for drug discovery. I think for this audience here, everybody knows that the pharmaceutical innovation is endangered. It usually takes about $1.8 billion or $2 billion on average in 12 years to go from the beginning to the end in terms of drug development. One of the major reasons for the inefficiency is because of the inaccuracy of the preclinical drug discovery assays. Drugs work in mouse, do not work in humans, and we see that time after time. Another reason is that the cardiac toxicity is the number one cause of drug withdrawal post-marketing. The concept here is very simple, right? So if I'm a drug company and I give you a drug and you have a rash, I probably don't care. I just say put some cream on, right? Steroid cream on it. On the other hand, if I'm a drug company, I give you a drug, and next morning you don't wake up, I care because I'm going to get sued, right? And so this is the reason the cardiac toxicity is the number one cause of a drug withdrawal post-marketing, accounting for about 35%. Now put yourself in terms of a drug company's perspective 10, 20 years ago. So you don't have access to patients' cardiomyocytes. You have access to mouse neonatal cardiomyocytes. I told you earlier, mouse and human are not the same. Mouse cardiomyocytes are actually very finicky. You know, they only stay alive in the dish for about 4 to 5 days. And so what most people do is that they take a Chinese hamster ovary cell. Again, I emphasize the word ovary. Ovary cells do not beat, right? And they take ovarian cells, overexpressed with HER channel, and then they do all the drug screening on this, right? And so you're betting that your drug affects the HER channel, and therefore it pops up. So if you have a drug that blocks the HER channel, you basically kill the drug. If you have a drug that blocks the sodium channel, you won't get detected in this traditional assay, so the drug will go through the pipeline here. And this is, this is also part of the reason why a lot of drugs have been withdrawn for one reason or another related to poor arrhythmia, heart attack, QT interval prolongations. And so I give you the example of Cisapri. Cisapri was withdrawn in 2000. When I was a health staff, I probably given out 500 prescriptions of Cisapri. We give it to diabetic patients with gastroparesis. It works wonderfully well. For some reason, in 2000, when I was a health staff, we were notified that we can no longer give Cisapri. And what's the reason? Well, Cisapride was marketed by, it was called Prepulsit, marketed by Johnson & Johnson. And the FDA found that there were some issues with long QT and Torsades, and about 400 reported cases, about 80 death. Drug which won in the market in 2000, $90 million awarded in terms of class action lawsuits. And so we decided to go back to this drug because of my historical fascination with this drug. We did a cardiac clinical trial in the DISH. Took 12 patients, three control, three long QT patients, three hypertrophic patients, three dilated cardiomyopathy patients, make the iPSLs, differentiate the cardiomyocytes. You will see at baseline the action potential of the long QT is already prolonged, so which makes sense, they have long QT. When you expose them to low dose Cisapride, nothing happens. When you expose them to very high dose Cisapride, all of them got arrhythmia. Now, what happens if you expose them to physiologic dose, somewhere between 30 to 100 nanomolar? This is very interesting to us. So if you expose them to physiologic dose, normal patient right here, actually nothing happens. It's only patients who got long QT or hypertrophic, they get into trouble. And dilated, actually nothing happens. So this begs a question, why is it out of 10 million people who took the medication, only 400 reported cases of QT interval and Torsades, and only 80 death? Is it true that if I give Cisapride to everybody in this room, all of us will be dropping dead? Probably not. It's probably patients who have pre-existing disease, they get into trouble. Normal patients, they're fine. Except back in 2000, we were not routinely checking EKG. We were not routinely checking echocardiogram when we give out this medication. And so if you have this data right now in the drug development phase, you probably do one or two things. One, you just kill the drug. Two, you ask a chemist to go back and reformulate it so that this disappears. Right here. And so this is, in my opinion, an example of having more information will help you in terms of the drug development. Let me give you another quick example. This is verapamil. Verapamil is an L-type calcium channel blocker approved by the FDA in 1982 for treatment of high blood pressure, angina pectoris, and cardiac arrhythmia. It's considered the workhorse of cardiac medication because it's so cheap and we give it to a lot of people. And so if you put the verapamil on CHO cells, the Chinese hamster ovarian cell that overexpress the HERG channel, verapamil is actually low IC50. It's toxic. It's not safe because it blocks the HERG channel. What happens if you put verapamil on my iPSL cardiomyocyte? The IC50 is actually quite high. It tells you it's a safe drug. The reason is the verapamil blocks the HERG, which prolongs the QT. You also block the calcium channel, which shortens the QT. So at the end of the day, you balance out each other. And so this is an example of a false positive drug testing in which it's cardiotoxic using CHO cells, but it's actually safe using patient iPSL cardiomyocyte. So the question is, why is this drug in the market then? Well, keep in mind this drug was approved in 1982. So the CHO cells with the HERG channel, they, you know, people started testing around 1993, 1994. So this is the reason why it's in the market. If he had come out with this drug today, he would have been killed during the R&D phase because it affected the HERG channel right here. The other thing what we're trying to do, as Evan says, is the genome editing. This is a pretty big portfolio in our lab. We have several people working on it. And so the main reason is that it bypasses patient recruitment. So in the past, I had to go after the dilated cardiomyopathy with troponin T. I had to go after the hypertrophic with the myosin heavy chain 7 mutation. Now, I can just do genome editing and create mutations. And let me just give you an example. This is a normal patient unedited, and this is by pass clamping to show the action potential pattern here. This is a patient who has the long QT1 mutation. You can already see a prolonged action potential. We now take this patient, your normal control, do genome editing to express the same mutation, you can see the prolonged action potential. And so this only took us about 2 to 3 months to get this whole process set up. And so I think, in my opinion, this is going to also be a game changer in terms of using genome edited lines to do your drug discovery phase right here. So in our lab, we actually have my iPSLs, and the postdocs are doing genome editing of my iPSLs to create 96 different mutations. And so you probably cannot see this right here. These are different kind of myosin, laminin, ACTC mutations and so forth right here. So this is from 1 to 48. And another one, another whole list right here. So think about how long it would take me to recruit these patients. I may never see them in the clinic because, you know, unless we do DNA sequencing on them, we don't know what the mutation is. Now it's only going to take me about 2 years to create 96 different lines that has all these mutations. And so once we make them, we'll also make them available to the public as well. The last thing is we're also going after different ethnicity difference. This is a recent study that I just briefly highlight, showing that iPSLs actually have some major differences depending on what the ethnicity you are. So this is the ALDH genetic polymorphism. It explains for how why some Asians, including myself, when I drink alcohol, my face flush, and that's because I don't have this enzyme. It's actually a protective gene against alcoholism because you can't drink too much. It's also a good gene because it's a lazy man's exercise. So you don't have to exercise, you just drink it, your heart rate shoots up to 150s and you flush. We recruited 10 Stanford undergrads who are Asian Americans. Five of them had the mutation, five of them do not. Make iPSL, differentiate the heart cells, expose them to some kind of different kind of stress, and clearly show that the undergrads with the ALDH mutation, their cardiomyocytes is much, much more susceptible to different kind of stress. Also explains for clinical studies and epidemiology studies showing that Asians who have this particular mutation are more susceptible to coronary artery disease. So this is what we're trying to do at the Stanford Cardiovascular Institute. We're trying to make a bank of about 1,000 lines for drug discovery. And this will consist of different ethnicity, different sex, different age, using Taylor and CRISPR. We routinely do DNA and RNA-seq on them. We also link it to the PharmGK database with Russ Salmon's group. And then for all the patients, we have a very, very clear database-driven bioinformatics platform. And we're working with the NHLBI on the iPSL biobanking, and also working with the FDA on drug safety testing. And we're going to set this up as a shared resource.
So as of today, if you have an interesting cardiac patient, you can send us the blood. We will make it. We will bank it at Stanford. We'll give you back the iPSL cardiomyocyte for free. Okay,
and so this is a interesting. This is a very important setup for us. So I just want to conclude by acknowledging the postdocs, my collaborators at Stanford, and also my collaborators outside of Stanford. And I think, if I may, I just want to spend 1 minute showing you three cases. So I'm a cardiologist, a clinician, as I explained in the beginning. We always like to end or start a presentation by case scenario. So this is a case scenario number one. You're the big pharma. This is 2020. You're the CEO of a company. The high cost of R&D is killing into your margins. This is bad. Clinical trials are costly and show mostly negative data. And you're interested in adopting new assays that will allow you to study, in my case, cardiac channels, metabolism, contractility, and also to screen for toxicity. So, you know, here we're trying to develop these iPSLs exactly for this platform. Now, this is 2025, 10 years later. You and your spouse has five kids. Two of them already had heart transplant at age 15 and 12. The other three at age 10, 7, and 5 are fine. Now, the DNA sequencing, if it's done at Stanford, we couldn't find any mutation. And you ask your doctor, me, what's going to happen to your other three kids? We said, we don't know. We're just going to do echo and MRI on your three other kids, right? Not very satisfactory to your patients. Now, if I were to propose to you that patient 15 and patient 12, the age 15 and age 12, the iPSL cardiomyocyte does not squeeze. The age 10 and age 7, they squeeze like this. And age 5, they do not squeeze. Even though I do not know what the mutation is, am I confident enough to tell the family that age 5 will develop the disease later on, and we're going to do a much more aggressive surveillance and also start the medication earlier? So this gets into the concept of personalized diagnostics for the iPSLs. And lastly, this is what I really care about. This is 20 years from now. You're the doc, and your patient with heart attack or heart failure needs to be on medicines, what medicine should you give them? Instead of having your patient as a guinea pig, can you test the drugs first on their mini-me surrogates using the different platforms out here? And I think this will be quite interesting for our discussion. And with that, thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.